Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I want to remind my audience that we Zoom on Monday afternoon. So again, what happens on Monday night? I have to wait a couple of days. We begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. Yesterday, during our Rethink the Week, I read a portion of his Washington Post op-ed, which was, as one of my friends says, he's such a mensch. such a beautiful piece. And what I want to do today is, because I posted that Washington Post op-ed, but I also shared with them the testimony that we actually air on this radio program. And when I went back to the testimony, I want to start with a paragraph before you actually hear him. And this is what he said. I want to take a moment to recognize the courage of my colleagues who have appeared and are scheduled to appear before this committee. I want to state the character attacks on these distinguished and honorable public servants is reprehensible. It is natural to disagree and engage in spirited debate, and this has been the custom of our country since the time of our founding fathers. But we are better than personal attacks. Frankly, the uniform I wear today is that of the United States Army. The members of our all-volunteer force are made up of a patchwork of people from all ethnicities, regions, socioeconomic backgrounds who come together under a common oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. We do not serve any political party. We serve this nation. That's the lead-in to what you're about to hear. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, keep that voice in your head as you exercise the franchise in November of 2020.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, our first guest. I've been working on him to get him back on the show, so I'm really glad that American University did this survey because it becomes a great excuse to grab Sam Fullwood III. There were three people involved in this survey at American University: David Barker, Sam Fullwood III, and Leonard Steinhorn. And you were so excited about this, Sam. And now I kind of understand why. But I have to tell you that this is a survey of the Black swing voter. And you looked at Black voters in strategic states. So this was not across the country. You were very targeted, and I understand why you targeted those states. And then you sort of, I think you sort of had it heavily weighted for younger people, which I think is interesting because it's a demographic we're still trying to figure out what their politics is, whether they want to exercise the franchise, what they think of elected leaders, because their experience is limited, let's be honest. And during the course of their lifetime, they've had too many distractions, Sam. So I want to let folks know that I pulled down the press release from American University. I'm going to do the opening sentence. And then, Mr. Fullwood, I want you to sort of share the just interesting information. A new survey of Black Americans in six battleground states released by American University's Black Swing Voter Project finds, this is even hard to say, that Black men and women under 30, compared to their elders, have far less trust in elected officials and far less enthusiasm for voting for former Vice President Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. And then they go into all this interesting breakdown. So Sam, tell us which states you targeted. Explain to us sort of a little bit of the layout of those you were seeking to poll And then let's sort of go into the breakdown, because the breakdown in a lot of ways is not surprising, but I'm just trying to figure out what the way of rehabilitating those results is, because that's really what the point of this is. It's to sort of give us a snapshot, and then we have to figure out what is the prescription. So welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Arnie, for having me back. Good to see you and to see Ken.
Yeah.
You're right. I am very excited about this study. And what I have been arguing for a long, long time is that our political infrastructure, let's say, the media, political consultants, candidates, have all taken Black voters for granted. That their attitude is that we show up on, that is, Black voters show up on Election Day, and as long as you get a Black preacher to come out and talk to them, then you've got the vote. That is, the Democrats have the vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been going on for a long time. And I have argued that we needed to take a much more multifaceted view of African-American voters. And that's what prompted this study. I have the opportunity now, because of the election, to sort of drill down and have people's attention as a result of the upcoming election. So we went into the so-called swing states. In the Rust Belt, they were Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And in the so-called Sun Belt, or the Southeast Sun Belt, they were Florida, Georgia, and North Carolina. Swing states are, as everybody knows, they're the ones that sometimes oscillate between Democrats and Republicans, or at least that's what people think.
Mm-hmm.
And swing voters are almost uniformly thought of as white people in those swing districts, suburbanites, working class, soccer moms, yeah. Reagan Democrats, all of those are the terms that people think of as swing voters. They don't think of African Americans as swing voters because they think that they are all going to vote for Democrats. So we wanted to test that. And so we talked to about 200 people in each of those states, and we oversampled to get what young people were thinking.
Yeah.
And the results were astounding. We found that overall, African Americans tended to vote for, or say that they intend to vote for Biden, and that they're very loyal, supposedly, to the Democrats. But that hides the real truth of the matter. If you break it down by age, and age seemed to be a real big dividing line for us.
Let me just say to everyone, please pay attention to this, because the age breakdown was shocking for me. It was shocking. And I have to take my hat off to you, because I think you smelled it and you sensed it, but now you have the empirical data to say, this is what I know. All right, keep going.
What we found was that 47% of the respondents that are under 30 said that they were going to vote for Biden. 47. That's less than half. Compare that to over 60. 86% said that they were going to vote for Biden. 86%. In the 30 to 59%, 70% said that they were going to vote for Biden. But let's go back to that under 30 group again.
Yes, please.
Nearly a quarter of them, 21%, said that they were not going to vote at all. Another 24% said that they weren't sure, or they were going to vote for somebody other than Donald Trump or Joe Biden. So you put all that together and you're looking at another 41% roughly, 40% roughly, that aren't going to be participating in an effective way in this election.
So I want to tie those numbers that you just told me. What was the number of young people who are not going to be voting for, or might be voting for Trump or not voting for Biden? What was that number? 20?
Trump gets 8% of the young vote, of the young Black vote.
He gets 8% of the young Black vote is what he gets.
Which is higher than any other age group among Black people. 8%.
What I thought was amazing was that when you asked the question, is President Trump a racist? This is where I wanted to like lay on the couch. It's like 21% of young African Americans said they disagreed with the fact that he's a racist. I want to know what they think a racist looks like. I want to know what they think a racist sounds like, because if Trump is not a racist, what is a racist, Sam Powell? 21% is a big number. That's a huge number from my perspective.
That's not the number that really is important there. If you look at the poll and you look back at the young people and you ask them, do you like his policies or the way he talks about his policies? They will tell you, no, we don't really care that much about his policies. 22% said that he's doing a good job. 35% said they like his strength and his defiance. Now, let's examine that a little bit.
Okay, because I have a response to that. So you start and then I'll follow.
Okay. We also conducted a series of focus groups with oversampling again with young people mm-hmm. in those same states. And so we asked them about, you know, what do you think about Donald Trump? And the response that we got back was, oh, he's a racist. We don't like his policies. They're bad and everything. But I love the way he sticks it to the man. I love the way that he stands up for his supporters. We think his supporters are deplorables, if you want to use that, or racist. But gosh, wouldn't it be great if somebody Black did that for us?
Okay, so you know what I wrote down? This is a famous Bill Clinton line. You're going to recognize it as soon as I saw that. I wrote this in the piece of paper. Bill Clinton always said, it's better to be loud and wrong than quiet and right. The idea of being strong and wrong and weak and right. And the problem we've done, and let me just say something. Here's what I think about politicians. And I think these young people are impressed with Donald Trump, because what we have done, because of money in politics, because of the revolving door, because of the fact of the lure of incumbency, we have drained the ability of politicians to actually complete the sentence, to speak their mind. They're always waffling. They're always sort of walking the center of the road, and they're not taking a position. And in the end, that's not satisfying. And these young people see Donald Trump, who sticks his middle fingers up in stereo and basically does everything. And it's refreshing, even if it's wrong, because they haven't seen it on their side. And Bill Clinton's words, it's better to be strong and wrong than weak and right, kept resonating in my ear, because that's exactly what they said.
That is what this study tells us. So these young people that we talked to were highly informed. They knew what was going on. They could tell you about Joe Biden and the crime bill in 92. They could tell you about Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. They could tell you about the Central Park Five and Donald Trump. They understood. They knew what was going on. And they said, a pox on all your houses. Nothing that any of them are going to do will be good and satisfying to my life. I'm concerned about police abusing me. I'm concerned about being able to get a job. I'm concerned about high cost of student loans. They were informed, and they had made what one could argue to be a really rational argument about their choices. And their choice was, I'm not playing this game. Now, give me somebody that speaks to me about the issues that I'm concerned about, and then I'll play. I'll be interested then if you give me a candidate that talks about the issues that affect me and my community.
And Ken, you want to weigh in? Hold on.
This theory, Sam, that the young people liking the way Donald Trump shows strength and fix it to the man, maybe more, they like that characteristic, but that doesn't necessarily mean they'll vote for him for that reason.
Because
they themselves are not going to take BS from the man, from the establishment, from the centrist Democratic Party, or whatever it is who gives lip service to my concerns, whether young Black people's concerns. And I want to make sure that somebody's going to stand up, and by God, I'm going to stand up for what I believe. And I don't care if Tom Perez thinks it's going to mess with Biden's ability to get elected.
I had a young man in Philadelphia tell me that this would be the last election that he's going to vote, and he's going to vote for Biden. He says, this is the last election that I vote for a Democrat. I'm not going to vote for a Democrat after this year.
Unless they do something. No.
Well, he didn't add that.
He didn't even add that. Oh, yeah.
And what his argument was is, I am tired of being taken for granted. Now, if a candidate comes to me and says the things that I want to hear, I'm going to listen. But I'm going to change my party affiliation to independent, and I'm going to be courted in much the same way that those swing voters that we talked about a minute ago in the soccer moms and the Reagan Democrats and the working class and all of those, they are courted. They are talked about. They are written about. And nobody writes about the options and the strategy to get Black voters to vote for one candidate or another.
So, you know, having covered the primary, because I'm in New Hampshire, so I've been covering the primary from the very beginning. So I watched every speech and whatever. As I'm listening to you, do you know who courted the African-American vote more than anyone else? Elizabeth Warren. I remember watching Elizabeth Warren in Texas give a speech to a group of Black women from all over the country. And what was amazing was the person who got the biggest applause, the person who said, she's talking to me, the person who said, her policies understand my life. It turned out it was Warren. That's who it was. It wasn't Kamala. It wasn't. And that's what's so interesting, because I think they didn't know that they would respond that way. But when you watched all the candidates sort of doing their dog and pony show, and then, you know, Elizabeth Warren, the reaction there was visceral. You could see it.
Well, I have to, no disrespect to New Hampshire or Iowa, I have to say that it's long past the time that we started thinking that Iowa and New Hampshire reflect anything in the country. Elizabeth Warren did not connect with African-American voters in South Carolina where it mattered. She didn't connect with African-American voters in the Super Tuesday states.
Who did? Who did?
By that time, quite frankly, as my poll seems to suggest, nobody did.
Yeah, thank you. I agree.
But what it was a sense of, but look, let's go back. 2020 is not going to be a referendum on who's going to get what. It's a referendum against Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
Plain and simple, that's what it is. And so by the time that South Carolina and Super Tuesday rolled around, it was pretty clear that voters were making a pragmatic choice. Who is the best candidate to beat Donald Trump? We want to beat Donald Trump. We don't really fall in love with whether it's Kamala or Biden or Buttigieg or whomever. Who can beat Donald Trump? And it emerged by that time that person was going to be Joe Biden. And so,
How did that emerge? He came in last in all the previous primaries.
Because of South Carolina. And when Representative Clyburn said, this is the guy that can beat him, and because he had done the field work in South Carolina, South Carolina gave him the momentum to go into Super Tuesday and to sweep all the chips off the table.
So in a lot of ways, what you're saying, though, is that of all the candidates, it was only because the African-American community basically sanctioned him in South Carolina, especially Clyburn, who up until a couple of weeks before wasn't even sure he was going to support Biden.
Absolutely.
He was disgusted. He had an affinity for him, but I think he was watching a campaign that never developed. To be honest with you, what were Biden's positions on anything?
I don't think that there was ever any doubt that Clyburn was going to throw his support behind the Biden campaign. That was the centrist and the mainstream Democratic choice. The question was whether he would have been pushed to support Harris at that point, if she had a groundswell of support that he could discern, and that didn't happen prior to South Carolina.
Do your young people under the age of 30 want a centrist, say not much, don't complete the sentence, have to explain the past, not quite sure? I mean, what I know about Joe Biden is
Let me tell you what the young people
say. What do they
want? So when you ask young people, who in public life inspires you? Well, let me back up. Before that, we asked them, who in history inspires
you? I want to hear the answer.
Malcolm X.
He wasn't middle of the road.
Then you ask, who in contemporary life? And you can see in the focus groups, you can see their eyes glaze over. And basically they do the, I don't know. And then you push them. Well, give me a name. Name somebody. Who in public life are you inspired by? LeBron James. So then you say, well, why LeBron James? And they say, well, he puts his business and his life and his career on the line for Black people.
He does the walk.
I want someone in politics to do what LeBron James does. So it's not that they think that Joe Biden is going to do that. It's not that they think that Elizabeth Warren or even Kamala Harris is going, or even, so we would say, well, what about Obama? Well, yeah, he's a nice guy. What they want is someone that's going to say, you are central to America. You are important. And I want you to be a part of this, which is what Donald Trump says to his 30% of Americans that have taken over the Republican Party.
You're absolutely right.
That's what these young African Americans are telling me in my survey and when we talk to them. And nobody else is talking to them about this.
Okay.
And that's the problem that the Democrats have.
So you asked the question, ready? Let's say you wanted to change something in your city or local community, such as police brutality or police practices that concern you. How effective do you think each of the following are at making sure that change takes place? And you went to elected officials and journalists and business leaders and protesters. Numero uno, number one, Black Lives Matter. And I get it. I so get it. Because everyone else has disappointed. Everyone That's else exactly hasn't, right. hasn't been like a laser focusing on it. And Black Lives Matter has really opened everybody's eyes. It isn't just about what they think they can do, it's what they have done for the rest of us. Let me be honest.
So when you look
now.
At that very question and you look all the way down at elected officials, you see that they are dragging the bottom.
If you ask me what do I predict the outcome of that survey question would be, I would say Black Lives Matter by a long shot.
It is on a scale of 1 to 10.
Right, right.
So when you measure it that way, it's a lot larger.
Well, and I think if you asked the question about Black Lives Matter maybe a year and a half ago, there wouldn't be the same kind of resonance because of what happened in Minneapolis, because of what happened on the streets of Washington, because we're seeing Black Lives Matter in New York City in front of Donald Trump's building. When you see all that, all of a sudden, it is they're realizing the power that now is finally being acknowledged, and not by them, but by us. And
yes,
I mean
that is
all
true.
Of us. It is so in a lot of ways, it's so resonant in everyone's mind. And I think that is a sign of success because they actually do see success because all of a sudden people that have never uttered those words are now not only embracing those words, but they're painting them on their damn streets.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to see what happens come November, whether these young people will remain politically agnostic or whether they will see the existential threat posed by Donald Trump and move that way. But I think this is a wake-up call. I think this is a warning for people to know.
It's an important warning. And the other thing is that you did ask the question about police and reactions to police. And do me a favor, do this with a bunch of white people too. I want people to see the contrast of being a young Black under the age of 30 and being a young white under the age of 30. And when you see a cop, when you see 80%, I think was the number, Sam, they don't see it in a positive light. They see it in a negative light. They're worried about themselves. They're worried about their family. And I keep screaming going, these are supposed to be officers of the peace. They're supposed to be stabilizing, you know, public servants. And then I saw that number, and it doesn't surprise me, but I think that number needs to be a billboard on Times Square because it really does speak to the fact that that fear is legitimate. And unfortunately, we need to change that above anything. That has to change if we're going to create stability, not only for our communities, but for their lives.
Could I ask you, Sam, are you going to do any subsequent research on what might be an implication from these findings, which could be the big tent theory? To the extent that young African-American people want a government person to speak for them the way LeBron does and uplift their concerns with vigor, the problem with the centrists in the party is that they will not do that because they have to kowtow to the Wall Street voters and the Wall Street donors and the suburban moms and whoever else they want to bring into their big tent. And if you're going to be really advocating progressive causes, you might have to have a party that is very different than what the Democratic tent looks like.
Yes. Well, to answer your question, this was the first phase of our study. And what we're really interested in is not so much who they're going to vote for, but what this really is the implication for our society. If you have 18 to 30-year-olds now, 18 maybe voting for the first time or not voting for the first time, what does that mean 15 years down the road when political scientists say how you vote in your first three elections determine whether you'll vote for the rest of your life?
Exactly.
If you have a group of people who are disaffected, how does that affect our families and our incomes and our society when they turn 40 years old or 60 years old?
So if I was sitting in that room and there was a focus group of those guys, I'd say, it's your demographic that's taking over. Don't punt now. This is not only your moment, but this is going to be your country. You know, get the muscle. Start developing the muscle now, because this is yours, not mine.
They have to believe that the country is there for them, and that they don't believe that now. Yeah. And that's the reason they aren't participating. So we're gonna follow up.
I'm gonna call you again.
We're gonna have another release in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
This was just the tip of the iceberg that we wanted to get out because it impacts the presidential campaign more than anything else.
All right, American University's Black Swing Voter Project. My excuse to grab Sam Fullwood III. We'll grab him again when the next phase comes out. You gave us a lot to think about. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure to be with you both, Ken and you, Arnie. Love you all.
All right. Love you both. Yes. All right, ciao. All right, everyone, stick around. When we come back, another person I love, Harold Meyerson of the American Prospect. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day National Guard troops in Minneapolis raided Teamsters Local 574 headquarters. Over 150 were arrested, including top strike leaders Bill Brown and the Dunn brothers, who were imprisoned in military stockades. Troops also seized union records and files. They then raided the Central Labor Union and forcing out dozens of area labor leaders. The Teamsters had been battling the trucking bosses and the Citizens Alliance throughout the spring and summer in what would be a turning point for industrial organizing. Finally, drivers agreed to a tentative settlement, but the bosses rejected any deal, refusing to negotiate with Reds. Farmer Labor Party Governor Floyd Olson declared martial law the next day. 4,000 troops arrived, issuing unlimited military permits to scab drivers. By month's end, over 7,500 scab trucks were rolling throughout the city. Local 574 challenged the martial law, demanding that peaceful picketing and open-air meetings be reinstated. They also wanted troops withdrawn from the city, and they wanted all truck movement halted for 48 hours. When Olson rejected these demands, a mass rally was called for the 31st to mobilize strike support. 25,000 turned out to the parade grounds, cheering strike leader Bill Brown, who declared, quote, "The Farmer Labor Party is the best strike-breaking force our union has ever gone up against." Historian Brian Palmer notes, the loudest and longest applause was reserved for Albert Goldman, who thundered, quote, "If we submit without a struggle, then we deserve the fate of submissive slaves. We cannot, we dare not submit. We call upon the workers, organized and unorganized, to clench their fists, shout defiance of the bosses, and struggle until victory or death."
Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? We've started our good battle, we know we're sure to win, because we've got the gun thugs looking very thin. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? They say they have to guard us to win. educate their child. Their children lives in luxury. Our children's almost wild. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? With pistols and with rifles, they take away our bread. And if you miners hinted it, they'd beat you on the head. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? If you go up to Harlan County, there is no neutral there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Hi, this is part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Harold Meyerson writes for the American Prospect. We love schmoozing with Harold because he's always writing about things going, I wish I had said that. I wish I had said that. So Harold, there's so much on my plate, but I do need to tell you, and I actually sent you a note about this. I posted your very, very short little pithy piece entitled Mitt Romney and the Short Rope. I can't even tell you, more people have been going, this is great. I got to use that line. So I want you, Mitt Romney looks so reasonable right about now. We're looking at the Republican Party imploding following Donald Trump, you know, off a cliff. We're seeing them not being able to deal with the whole idea of the unemployment benefits and, of course, the evictions. And Mitt comes out with what seems like such a reasonable, middle-of-the-road answer. So why don't you explain how you described him and what you mean by the short rope?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think the larger context is that the Republicans before Trump were not exactly a bargain either. We can get to that after this. But what I noted last week that Romney had said, oh no, we shouldn't cut off the $600 weekly unemployment benefit that the federal government has been giving for a number of months now, just like that. We should, you know, we're not going to cut it to 200. We should cut it to 400 for 1 month, and then to 200 for the second month, and eliminate it in the third month. And that reminded me, when I was 18 years old, I worked on the presidential primary campaign of Minnesota Democratic Senator Eugene McCarthy, who was an anti-war candidate running against Lyndon Johnson in 1968. And, you know, I heard a bunch of his speeches. In one of his speeches, he said, you know, the Republicans adhere to the short rope theory. A man is drowning 50 feet offshore, from shore. The Republicans throw him a 30-foot rope and say, we've gone more than halfway.
Harold, it is the best line I have ever heard. And of course, well, it was nice seeing you too, but you still have to drown. I mean, it's just,
Yeah. And you know, that's what Mitt Romney's proposal is short rope Republicanism. I should add that Eugene McCarthy was a brilliant, somewhat, you know, flawed liberal. But he had a you know, verbal ingenuity that very few political elected officials can match. And that was one example of that. But I think the broader, you know, the broader issue here, some of Trump's Republican critics who are now doing mea culpas every 3 seconds are saying that Trump simply is the, you know, huge exaggeration of all the flaws of the Republican Party that they've been building, you know, since Eisenhower, basically, and mm-hmm. before that as well. You know, the short rope theory explains a lot of what the Republicans are doing. And remember, you know, the Republicans, well before anyone imagined Donald Trump would ever run for president, were repealing Obamacare every 2 weeks in the House and Senate, and never enough votes to overcome Obama's veto, without ever coming up with a plan to replace it. They, you know, and you know, they're still fumbling, what is it, a full decade after that plan was passed. That suggests to me a party which simply cannot engage with the reality of the lives that Americans live and really don't have the slightest clue as to what to do about real crises. They can manufacture fake crises. There's the immigrants, there's, you know, the socialists and communists in the Democratic Party, all of this. But when it comes to a real crisis, they are clueless with a capital C.
But you know why they're clueless, Harold? When your whole ideology has been since, 1980 at least, no government, no regulation, no taxes, you know, the idea of laissez-faire capitalists, you know, I mean, the whole idea that somehow laissez-faire government, that if they have always embraced the idea that government really is, as you point, as we've heard over and over again, is not the solution, it's the problem. And if that's what you've said, and now you've got Donald Trump, who's taken all that ideology that they have had baked in. I mean, think about it. We're still at $7.25 an hour for a minimum wage. Oh my God, nobody. I mean, that isn't even a short rope, that's no rope, okay? So when you begin to look at this ideology and then you see Donald Trump, he is kind of a caricature of everything they have been saying forever. And you know Absolutely. What, they don't like regulation? Well, they've been gutting all the regulations. You don't think that government needs to be there? Well, they're not there. You know, you don't think you need healthcare? Well, we don't have healthcare. I mean, everything they've been saying is now we're living, and guess what? It doesn't work at all.
We need to take a longer view of the arc, because even going back to 1920, Coolidge and Harding and Herbert Hoover were also the same laissez-faire capitalists, and it wasn't until the New Deal that we even had anyone saying that the government should do something to help ordinary people.
Yeah, well, this is historically what the Republican Party has been. There have been times where Republicans have made accommodations for a while with the New Deal. I mean, Eisenhower was rather explicit that, there was no way Republicans could repeal Social Security or, you know, go to a major war against unions. I don't think that was Eisenhower's liberalism. It was his pragmatism since Social Security and unions were working.
Yep.
And were very popular at that time. But the Republicans around Ronald Reagan, a lot of whom were Sunbelt capitalists who had never accepted unions and never accepted the idea of government intervention. Let's remember Barry Goldwater, who kind of kicked off the Reagan era 16 years before Reagan was elected, was opposed to Social Security. This was the Sun Belt wing, which was the more radical right wing of the Republican Party. And then, you know, that ideology spread from the Sun Belt to virtually every elected Republican, which absolutely laid the groundwork for Donald Trump.
So Harold, hasn't the pandemic taught them anything? I mean, I'm hearing that, you know, Donald Trump's son's school, Barron's school, has COVID. So now the elite of the elite of the elite of the elite can't protect themselves.
Sure.
I'm looking at Louis Gohmert, and everybody in the Capitol is ready to, like, you know, shoot him because, you know, he doesn't want to wear a mask. And then I'm doing a story with ProPublica at the end of the week, and it's about the cost of testing. And the doctor at the very end of this said, we should be paying people and begging them to test them. We should pay them, not have them pay to be tested. Because in the end, if we don't have accurate information, we're all going down. Don't they get it? Don't they see their vulnerability? This is the one place where, as much as you want to put yourself in a gilded cage, you probably can't.
No, this is absolutely the reductio ad absurdum of laissez-faire, of
exactly.
Extreme individualism, of the notion that Margaret Thatcher once expressed, that there is no collective, there is no society, there's just individuals. Now, of course, a pandemic should undermine that belief in as much as your breathing can affect someone else's health. That shouldn't be a controversial idea, But, you know, the one wall that that's bumped up against and hasn't penetrated is Republican mentality, Trumpian mentality in particular.
Wow. You know, you would think that death would be something that they would be aware of. I'm just trying, if you can't see Herman Cain dying and you can't see what's happening with the numbers in Texas and you can't see what's happening to the numbers in Florida, I don't know how you can walk over the dead bodies, how you can fill the morgues and still be in this sort of sense of collective denial. Because in a lot of ways, it doesn't make sense, but it really sort of frightens me as to what have we created? Because you can't see this and, you know, and come up with the math that said, this isn't working.
Well, for Trump himself, I think our guide has to be his niece, whose book makes very clear the roots of his complete incapacity for empathy. Yeah. So I kind of understand this with Trump, why he has schlepped along Republicans who presumably didn't have quite such a pathological upbringing as Trump himself is a good question. And that gets to sort of the primitive tribalism, which, you know, in a way, much of contemporary Republicanism has been reduced to. It's our tribal allegiance, and so that's our wall against reality. In Trump's case, it's his psyche. But for Republicans who are sticking with him on this, it's simply this hard tribal sense of whatever Trump is saying is what we're going to do, what we're going to think.
So I want to go to something that I think is really important, and it was the piece that you wrote a couple of weeks ago, and it was really the reason I sort of reached out to you, and it was entitled "When a Workplace is Safe." The workers will decide when a workplace is safe. And you refer to an article back in April by Nelson Lichtenstein, the Dean of American Labor Historians, who wrote a piece, and you wrote, arguing that states should establish workers' councils that would decide when it was safe to return to their work sites and would have the authority to monitor those work sites for safety conditions when work resumes. I was so like, how come that hasn't happened? Where is the AFL-CIO? Where is the NEA? The NEA should say, you know what? We're not one teacher goes back in. We are going to be in charge of what it is that we are going to be asked to do and whether we think this is a situation that actually exhibits anything close to safety. Because it's not only about our health. It's not only about our children's health. But when our children go home, they're going to take the disease home with us. So frankly, if you make the workplace safe, you make America safe.
Yeah, well, in the case of teachers, you know, the American Federation of Teachers just had its biennial convention, and they said that if teachers don't think the workplace is safe, they shouldn't go back to work, and they would sanction a strike in a school district where the school district wants the teachers in, and the teachers have concluded that the workplace is not safe. But of course, this pertains, as in Nelson's article, to any workplace. And the reason I wrote that particular piece was because in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, which is five people with jurisdiction over the health and welfare issues of LA County, which is 10 million people, it's a lot larger than many states, said that they gave workers the right to deal with management on this issue. I don't doubt that this may be contested in court. And when Nelson was arguing this point, he was also thinking of, you know, a way workers can get around the absence of any kind of collective power at a time when only 6% of the private sector workforce is unionized. Nelson was thinking of the other 94% and what can they have certain emergency powers? Well, no state has granted them that power, but in LA County, which as I said, is larger than many states, the County Board of Supervisors, which is made up of the four very liberal Democrats and one relatively liberal Republican, has made that determination.
So Harold, you know, when I think about this, I wonder if Germany, as Germany approached their, you know, confronting their pandemic, they've always had an interesting relationship between management and labor. And there's always been this idea that there has been the ability to communicate and that there was more of a level playing field. Do we know that as Germany faced its pandemic, as Germany began to sort of figure out how to reopen businesses, schools, whether the dynamic that was just described in your article, whether that was really what how the table was set as people were brought back into the workplace, that it wasn't, you know, on high from the prime minister, that it wasn't from the scientific community only, and it wasn't from the boss, but it really was sort of from the bottom up, so that that sense of safety, and frankly, let's be honest, Harold, that sense of ownership.
Yeah.
If you're determining whether your workplace is safe, you own that result because it's your input it reflects.
Right. Well, Germany has a system which goes back way before the onset of COVID-19. It was partly originated as far back as the Weimar Republic. It wasn't around during the Third Reich, of course, but then it was a feature of West Germany and now Germany on the whole since 1950 or so. A system of co-determination. And on issues like this, every German workplace with at least 50 employees has something called a works council,
right,
where workers regularly resolve issues with management, not wages and benefits, that's a separate thing, but precisely this kind of issue. And it's ingrained in the German system. And as people who are following the news about the pandemic, no, Germany has one of the best records of dealing with the pandemic,
exactly,
and of keeping the nation safe. So I think that kind of system really matters at a time like this. And it's one we are far from having.
So Harold, the talk for the last, you know, week and a half and probably for the next couple of days is going to be about Biden's VP pick.
Right.
So I'm kind of curious because I'm still trying to figure out exactly how Biden is going to lead, what he is going to embrace, whether I see his VP pick as kind of a code for where we're going. I'm just, obviously I want to get rid of Donald Trump. I want to bring back someone who obviously has the ability to express empathy. And if nothing else, Biden is empathy on steroids. He's phenomenal on that. But in the end, that is not going to repair just the amazing economic disaster, social disaster, health disaster, a lot of which preexisted the pandemic. So I'm kind of curious how you're seeing this VP pick, and do I get to use this as sort of my GPS for where Joe Biden will go going into hopefully an election where he wins?
I think that is not the right way to weigh the VP pick. I think Biden, who has a long centrist pedigree, has moved to the left for reasons that's required to unify the Democratic Party, and because he understands the nation is going through an upheaval, the likes of which it probably hasn't since the Great Depression descended. So, you know, I think the VP pick is only one of many that will chart where he is going. I'm not sure, you know, there are some candidates who are a little more democratic Ancien regime than others. Certainly Susan Rice, in some ways Kamala Harris. Karen Bass, whom I've actually known in Los Angeles for decades.
Tell me about her.
Well, she comes out of a real left background, and she has, in some ways, a very progressive understanding of issues and a very brilliant manner of addressing these. She headed a group called the Community Coalition in South Central during the height of the crack epidemic. And the people working for the group did a lot of neighborhood surveys and found that actually the main problem in terms of what was present in South Central, beyond the police force, which she was long a critic of, was liquor stores. Now, most of the liquor stores at that point in South Central were owned or operated and owned and operated by Korean immigrant families. And rather than turn this into a sort of ethnic war, Karen reached out to them, made sure there were transition funds made available by the city and the county.
Write
and
this
the
story. Write this story, Harold. Keep going.
I literally am. It'll be on the website by Wednesday.
I love you. Yeah, or the precursor. Yeah. Okay, keep going. Yeah,
and this is a precursor of like her work in the state assembly. She was a solid progressive, but even the Republicans, including a Republican in the California State Assembly named Kevin McCarthy, who is now the Republican leader in the House of Representatives, said, you know, we oppose her on everything, but we can really deal with her. We like her. I think she's amazingly talented. When I was thinking of Karen, I was reminded of a description Lenin once had of one of his possible successors, Nikolai Bukharin. Okay. He said, Bukharin is the rightful favorite of the whole party, the party being the Bolsheviks. And it strikes me that Karen might fit that description today.
Wow. Because
in her own very quiet, unassuming way, I think she's a bit of a political genius with solid progressive principles. But
well, really, I'm going to read your article, Harold Meyerson, and I'm going to share that article with everybody I know. I'm watching her and I'm impressed. I'm just telling you, and I want to know more. Yeah,
can I ask you a question about Karen Bass? And that is, I have seen two things yesterday and today which might give her some problems as the nominee. One is that she worked at the Fenceremos Brigade, which gives her high marks in my eyes, but I'm not the average American voter. And the other is that she had nice things to say about the Scientologists. And,
yeah, well, I think the latter is sort of an LA politics thing. I don't think Karen actually really has very high opinion of Scientologists. But look, she does have a real left background, as did a lot of the leaders of the Black community who emerged in the 50s and 60s of the older generation had come up in the 1930s in the Communist Party, because it was the just about the only pro-Black institution in the United States in the 1930s. Karen has a bit of a similar relation with some radical groups since she was 20 years old in South Central LA in the early mid 1970s. And those were the groups that were around. You know, that's sometimes the kind of background
I'm just asking how much it's going to affect her.
All I'm going to tell you is she's like vintage wine. You know, it's fruit juice to start, and then it turns into something remarkable because she's grown. And what you've described for me is an arc of maturing, an arc of relationship, an arc of respect, an arc of reaching out. And, you know, where you start is not where you end.
Right. Well, one further thought on Karen. Were Biden to pick Kamala Harris, then the California Senate seat comes open and Gavin Newsom gets an interim appointment. If Karen is not a VP pick, she'd be an incredible California senator.
Wow, this is like incredible. All right, Harold Meyerson, I adore you. The American Prospect, he is an editor at large. Read him, and we will definitely post his article about Karen Bass as soon as it goes to print. Thank you so much for joining us, Harold. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Arnie.
It's a pleasure.
Always love to be here.
Thanks, Harold.
All right. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
Hound, everybody to listen. I want to talk about the rich and the super rich, the poor and the super poor. Come on. Style. smiling, always trying to get more than they give.
Hold that little man down. Why don't they let him live? Ooh, let him live, let him live. Because a rich kid retires and the fun. Don't get caught up in that spotlight, please.